morning. This House of Fisheries Committee will come to order at 10:03 a.m. in room 120. Today is Thursday, March 19th, 2015. Members present are Representative Heron, Representative Foster, Representative Johnson, and myself, Chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. We are joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Sam Greeley from the LIO, and my Fisheries Committee today is Mary Strail. There she is. There's Mary. today we'll have one bill on the agenda, House Bill 112, an act repealing the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission and transferring its duties to a Commercial Fisheries Entry Division established in the Department of Fish and Game and the Office of Administrative Hearings, and providing for an effective date. And I would like to acknowledge Reverend Christ Tompkins, Representative Christ Tompkins, who just joined us. You've been promoted. It's not my intent to pass this bill out of committee today. I will have my staff present the bill. We will hear from the CFEC commissioners, and with that, we will have comments from the Department of Fish and Game. We will be taking testimony at the next scheduled hearing for HB 112, which will be next Thursday, March 26th. Reed, would you please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Reed Harris. I'm staff to you, Representative Stutes. House Bill 112 repeals the Commercial Fishery Entry Commission, assigns the Commission's adjudicatory functions to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and transfers the Commission's other duties, as well as employees, to a new Commercial Fishery Entry Division within the Department of Fish and Game. There's been recent interest in the Commission's operations. Last year, Rep. Seaton introduced House Bill 386 with the same language as this bill, and there's a legislative budget and audit report on the CFEC due out sometime this spring. A little history. In 1973, the legislature enacted the Limited Entry Act under 1643 and created the first comprehensive limited entry program in the country. The act created the CFEC as a regulatory body and quasi-judicial agency to implement and administer the program. Since its inception, the CFEC has limited fisheries to, entry to 68 fisheries, now 67, considered nearly 23,000 applications, and annually issues over 29,000 fishing permits and vessel licenses. The early period of the commission through the mid-2000s, and I'm paraphrasing, from the Lawson report here, the early period of the commission through the mid-2000s could be described as a triage situation. The workload was immense and the backlog of adjudications daunting. The Commission rightly chose cases where the immediate right to fish was at stake. This has come up in committee a couple of times now, but this could explain a delay of weeks or months, but likely not the decades that have passed for some of these cases to be finalized. Since then, the workload has diminished along with the Commission's output. The Commission averaged 115 final decisions per year for over 25 years, from 1982 to 2006. Over the past 2 years, the adjudication average has dropped to 3 cases per year. Currently, there are 28 license applications remaining total, and few fisheries are being monitored for limited entry. There's a graph in, if I could turn your attention to the 2007 CFEC annual report. If you don't want to dig for it, I have it right here in my hands. You can see sort of the workload is steadily declined, the top of the graph being 900, the bottom of the graph being sub 100, so they've got around 28 applications remaining. Also worth noting, the last fishery to enter limited entry was in 2004, so over a decade ago. House Bill 112 offers a significant cost savings to the state by deleting the 3 commissioner positions and creating a division director position within the Department of Fish and Game. Under Section 122 of the bill, all remaining CFEC employees would become DFG employees upon the effective date of the act. The fiscal note would show a savings of $425,000 a year, but greater potential savings in operating costs could be determined as the functions between the two entities are reviewed and efficiencies identified as there would be some overlap in the research, licensing, and IT sections of the Department of Fish and Game and the Commission. Lawson Report, page 49, has a table, if you care to look at it, regarding the exempt first classified service. It shows the salaries for most of the employees remain essentially the same, with possibly a step down of 1 or 2 points. There's also a legal memo regarding an issue where moving exempt employees into the classified service could be an issue, but there's precedent for this. This was done in 2009 with House Bill 63, which moved the Council of Domestic Violence from exempt into classified service. So all those employees went from exempt to classified. Section 20 of this bill provides that adjudications currently handled by the commissioners would be conducted by the Office of Administrative Hearings, an independent office whose mission is to, quote from their website, provide for the delivery of high-quality adjudication services that ensure fair hearings conducted in a timely, efficient, and cost-effective manner. The OAH usually works with a timeline of 120 days from when they receive an application to having a hearing. The Office of OAH bills on an hourly cycle. This is different than how CFEC works right now. The three commissioners are full-time commissioners with their salaries. OAH would bill whenever they're working on an actual adjudication. If you care to look at the Department of Administration fiscal note, it shows OAH billing at 375 hours at $165 an hour for a total of $61,900. Throughout the years, the CFEC's progress through a large caseload has produced a manageable situation. In our talks with OAH, we have been assured that they can wrap up the remaining cases in a timely manner and with a high degree of success. CFEC revenue is generated by fees it collects from commercial fishing permits and vessel licenses. Total revenue for FY 2014 was $7.8 million, of which the Commission used around $4 million. Under House Bill 112, revenue collected from permit fees would go to the Division of Commercial Fisheries to benefit the resource and the commission, the fishermen who depend on it. Again, to paraphrase Lawson, there's a clear direct relationship between the operations of the Division of Commercial Fisheries and the CFEC. The mission of the Division of Commercial Fisheries is to manage subsistence, commercial, and personal use fisheries in the interest of the economy and the well-being of the citizens of the state. The mission of CFEC is to control entry into Alaska's fishery resources and economic health of commercial fishing. Administering limited entry permits under the DFG umbrella would streamline the permitting and licensing process for fishermen. DFG could issue permits from their many offices around the state, whereas CFEC issues permits from a centralized location in Juneau. There have been a number of issues brought up with House Bill 112. I had one gentleman tell me that if this were to go through, it would be like having the fox guarding the hen house, where there would be a concern with lack of separation between political will and fish policy. Our feeling at the office is having an exempt division director and having the Office of Administrative Hearings manage the adjudications, the new Division of Commercial Entry would be able to maintain a high degree of political separation. Another issue that was brought to us by UFA and is mentioned again in the Lawson Report is capital projects concern. It's if all permit and license revenue is under the Division of Commercial Entry, all monies allocated would be for the direct benefit of the fishermen, whereas now DFG can sort of allocate that money wherever they care to. Third and not last, the Fisherman's Fund. People have asked if this would affect the Fisherman's Fund in any way. The Fisherman's Fund is administered through the Department of Labor and funded through CFEC receipts, and it's unaffected by this bill. To summarize, in times of limited budgetary resources, we need to look hard at making cuts to keep vital state services in place. This bill would become effective 90 days after it is signed by the governor. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer. We also have the Office of Administrative Hearings and Ledge Legal online to answer any technical questions about the bill.
Thank you, Reed. There is an amendment to House Bill 112, and I'd ask the committee to consider Amendment Number 1. Could I have a motion to adopt Amendment Number 1?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that we adopt Amendment Number 1. It's 29LSO485A1 Bullard 318. 15.
Thank you, and I'll object for the purpose of discussion. And Reed, could I have you please explain the amendment?
Thank you. Reed Harris for Representative Stutes. The amendment to House Bill 112 changes how the Office of Administrative Hearings makes a ruling on adjudications. OAH usually reviews the case and issues a recommendation to the head of the department for a final ruling. This is their default model. The one area where they don't do this currently is with tax and revenue cases where they actually issue a final decision. So this amendment makes the language change that empowers the OAH to make a final decision on adjudications themselves without the approval or oversight of the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. Having OAH make the ruling is an additional step to removing departmental oversight of permit adjudications. It should be noted that having OAH make final decisions on cases could signal an increase in their workload, and therefore a fiscal note could be required from the Department of Administration were this amendment to be accepted by the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this committee for the sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, we will next up have the commissioners from the CFPC. Commissioner Brown, Commissioner Twomley, and Commissioner Ruprecht, please step forward and state your name for the record. And I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Then the objection passes. Okay, gentlemen, please state your name.
Madam Chair, I'm Bruce Twomley, Chair of the Limited Entry Commission.
And I'm Benjamin Brown, a Commissioner at the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Good morning, Madam Chairman.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, I'm Vernon Ruprecht, Commissioner, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we would each like to address you with some short statements. I'd like to start just by calling your attention to the memo that we submitted to the committee. It's a memo that addresses the bill as is on its face by page and by line. I don't intend to go through that. There's detail in there, but I wanted to make some general comments about elements of the language in the bill, some of the issues raised by the bill, just with some short summary statements to begin with. And then I wanted to go on just some other comments. But reviewing the bill in terms of assigning duties within the department, I noticed that there are duties assigned to the commissioner and the division and the department. And looking at the bill overall, there is some overlap and some conflict between those duties. There are some instances where the same duties are assigned to two different entities. Additionally, there's discussion of a moratorium in the bill, and the commissioner is authorized to request a moratorium from the Board of Fish. What's not clear is whether the public has a part in that process. And if the public does have a part in the process, where do they take their request, to the commissioner or to the board? There's also a contrast that's presented because the commissioner seeking a moratorium is required to get the approval of the Board of Fish, but the commissioner has authority himself to impose full bore limited entry for an indefinite period on a fishery. And so the question arises, why need the board's approval for a temporary four-year moratorium, something that is going to go away by its own terms? There's also a provision of the bill addressing the power to revoke limited entry permits, and that's a power that the commission has had almost from the inception of the Limited Entry Act. What the bill will do is assign that power to a single hearing officer at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The legislature, when they created our act, took a different approach. They thought that this kind of decision was really too momentous to entrust to a single hearing officer, so they actually created a procedure where the commission as a whole, three commissioners, sit in and participate in the evidentiary hearing, and the commissioners do the final decision. But this would shift that responsibility to a single hearing officer. There's also a provision in the bill calling for all current hearings and proceedings to continue. And the question begs is how that's to happen. And that's because there's no savings clause in the bill for commission regulations or the body of administrative law developed by the commission that applies to those proceedings. There are regulations and a number of decisions that serve fishermen, help fishermen get what they're entitled to under the Act. It's unclear under this legislation what's to become of that body of controlling regulation and precedent. And then finally, you mentioned CFEC employees going over to the Department of Fish and Game. And the question, of course, is will they become part of the classified service? Will they be required to join a union? And will they be subject to a probationary period? But those are basically my general comments about the bill. I wanted to say a few things about what appears to me will be lost in the event this legislation passes under the amendment that you have before you. And one has to consider what happens if limited entry is put into classified service and what happens if the final decision is entrusted to a single hearing officer at the Office of Administrative Hearings. One loss will be limited entry's flexibility as an exempt agency to absorb budget reductions. The commission has always had that. I can give you an example of the utility of that. There was one year in which the commission received a mid-year budget cut applied to all exempt personnel. And the commission, with its flexibility, was able to assign reductions in hours and reductions in salaries to all of our employees to get through this period. And we did that by assigning the commissioners a 12% hit, and then there were reduced hits as you went down through to the lower salary schedules. And the remarkable thing about the commission is it's unlike any agency I ever sued in a former life. You can go into the agency at almost any time of any day of the week and find somebody at work. And we saw that when we applied this kind of draconian measure to get through the budget crisis. Employees, most of them continued to work their normal hours without quibbling. That's the nature of the agency. Another element will be lost. Commissioners are the final decision makers in the Limited Entry Commission, and we're more than administrative law judges in the agency because we make the rules. We adopt regulations. And that power to adopt regulations can be very helpful to fishermen because we have had fishermen come before us to argue that some of our regulations are unconstitutional or at the very least unfair. And when we've been persuaded of that, we had the power to change our regulations, to modify them. And some of you know Jim Brennan, a very good attorney out of Anchorage. We did that for one of his clients out of Prince William Sound a while back. And that's a power that the Office of Administrative Hearings does not have. The Office of Administrative Hearings does not have authority to modify the regulations of an agency whose hearing they conduct. There's also the element of agency expertise that I believe would be lost. And agency expertise actually serves efficiency. We know the issues, we know the authority, we can more efficiently, I think, resolve cases than someone who's paid to learn all of this material. Our Supreme Court has described the body of law governing limited entry as arcane. It's a very specialized area. There are very few people who are really functional in this area. There's a lot to be learned to be able to make this work. And I've given you one example submitted for the committee today. It's our case, the Bruno case, which I think I would ask you to pay some attention to it. I think it's a demonstration of agency expertise, and it's a companion case to the Violet Wilson case that we gave you earlier, the case about the grandmother threatened with a loss of some $40,000 of her life savings. But if you were to review those two cases, I think you would see the utility of agency expertise and the ability to step in and do something timely and responsive to the needs of the people before us. And then something I mentioned before, there is a threat that hangs over limited entry decisions. It comes from the Bahia cases and the Cashin cases. There's a risk that if the agency is reversed by the Alaska Supreme Court, that reversal can be applied retroactively to reopen previously closed applications and to allow new applications in a limited fishery long after the deadline. And so this holds the possibility of undermining a fishery on which Alaskans depend for their livelihood. Now, we have been able to successfully avoid this happening. We have a very good record before the Supreme Court in almost 20 years now. And we think that we have a handle on how to avoid this happening. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why Tom Lawson recommended in his report, Recommendation 19, that the current structure be maintained until the commission can get through at least the remaining cases out of the 68 originally limited fisheries. And finally, there's the question of speed in cases where the immediate right to fish is at stake. And those are the emergency transfers that come up on the eve of every season. The immediate right to fish is at stake. If those can't be handled very quickly, fishing time will be lost. Those are cases that when they're appealed to us, we can turn around in a matter of days, not the 120 days allowed for in the Office of Administrative Hearings. So I simply want to put that in front of you. I also think that the Violet Wilson case that you have is an example of the commission being able to intervene on very short notice and provide some timely relief to actually make relief available under the system that's really kind of complicated to penetrate, understand, and apply. But it's something that we're practiced in doing, and we have been able to serve fishermen, and that concludes what I wanted to put in front of you.
Are there any questions thus far? Okay. I have a few questions, but I'll wait until the other commissioners have had a chance to speak. So, please.
I believe I'm going to go next, Madam Chairman. Again, for the record, Benjamin Brown, Commissioner at the Commercial Fisheries Industry Commission. And it's a pleasure to be here this morning before the House Special Committee on Fisheries to discuss House Bill 112. I was a legislative aide in this building for many years before I went away to law school, and I have to hand it to your aide. I would never have been able to present a 47-page bill as rapidly as he was able to do so, because it is a complex bill, and then also to have an amendment, which I do appreciate having been given this morning about 7:45 a.m., that makes, I think, a very substantive change to the bill. And it's probably, as I said to Mr. Harris when we spoke about what the amendment was going to look like last night, and to your credit, Madam Chairman, you've been very forthcoming with information about this bill, about when we're going to have hearings, and I know things are fluid in a 90-day session, so I want to express my gratitude for that, because, the dialogue is very, very important. But the way the bill was originally drafted, the hugest ambiguity was who is making these final decisions. And so to the extent the amendment assigns the maximum amount of decision-making power to the Office of Administrative Hearings, that clarification is really, really important, because at least we know what we're dealing with as a proposed policy change. I would have to say, though, I don't think that there's a conceptual new fiscal note that needs to come out for that. I would imagine that's going to massively increase the resources the Office of Administrative Hearings has to deploy in order to handle the maximum amount of decision-making capacity that I think the amendment seeks to transfer to that agency. And I know that they stand ready to try to provide the most accurate information possible to this committee and to the entire legislature about what those resources would be. They have had, I think if you look at the existing fiscal note, had to rely on a lot of assumptions. I mean, there's six or seven assumptions in there, and those are based on information that they were given by the Department of Fish and Game about the least amount of decision-making capacity being transferred over. So that is a 180-degree turn based on the bill that we walked into committee this morning and that we're going to walk out of here with a different amendment to. So I just think that's something. The fiscal notes are important, even though we're not in finance yet. They're very, very important. Ours is the easy one to draft. We get zeroed out. But the ones from Fish and Game and the Office of Administrative Hearings are incredibly important, and the policy change that has been made by the unobjected to amendment this morning is something we should just all take a great deal of time and caution looking at. Secondarily, in terms of the presentation of the bill this morning, And I know they're very busy at Ledge Legal, and I remember what it was like being a legislative aide and bothering attorneys. They were down in the Goldstein building then, but when they moved over to the Terry Miller building, I don't know if a sectional analysis that provides more than just the title of each section is going to be forthcoming. I think that would be beneficial to, obviously, the members of your committee, Madam Chairman, and to everyone involved in this process, our friends at Fish and Game, at administrative hearings, everyone else in the room, so we actually know what the other sections of the bill do, because, again, I'm not certain that that level of analysis has been provided yet. One of the assumptions I did want to, before I get to my main point here, to observe is it actually says in the OAH fiscal note that the Department of Fish and Game does not envision limiting entry to any new fisheries in the next 5 years. I think that that is on its face inconsistent with the statutory duty to consider petitions to limit fisheries. I mean, whether it's a division director or an independent commission that we currently have, the whole basis of the Limited Entry Act is Alaskans have a right to come forward and say, and indeed non-Alaskans if they're permit holders, we think there's too much activity going on, you need to limit this. And if a decision has been prejudged by someone at Fish and Game that they're just not going to limit fisheries for 5 years, that's a source of grave concern to me. So I could editorialize more about some other things that I'm gravely concerned about, but I guess what I really would like to do is direct your attention to the CFE statement, which is a one-pager, which actually is two pages because there's stuff on the back. I've attempted to come and give that to each member of this committee and to answer questions one-on-one because I think that's the most important takeaway I would ask for members of the Special Committee on Fisheries to have this morning. We are an agency in transition. We are, like everyone else in state government, in a position now where we have to scrutinize how much we are spending on our operations and what value we're delivering to Alaskans with those scarce funds. And even though we generate a significant excess in revenues, which are now going to be applied to the operations of the Division of Commercial Fisheries, that doesn't excuse us from the duty to spend those public funds as economically and as cost-effectively as possible. So because we are an exempt agency, we are committed, I think, the three of us. They're right here, so they'll contradict me if I'm speaking out of turn for what their views on this are. We are extremely committed to analyzing what we do, how we do it, how much we're paying to do it, and every possible way how we might do it better. And we will set about, as soon as we are able to during this interim, to come back with a reorganization plan to present to this committee and anyone else who wants to listen in the legislature. And I think at that time, we will continue to make the case that there's a reason we were created independently and that the benefits of our remaining independent outweigh the relative cost of that independence. So if there are those who in the agency to which the bill proposes to transfer us really believe that they're going to be more efficient and more effective, I think it'll be incumbent upon them to be very specific about what those efficiencies and effectivenesses would be. It says in paragraph 3 of the sponsor statement, DFG can find efficiencies in the research, licensing, and IT functions at the CFEC. And that's sort of an inchoate promise to save money. And so I would think more specificity would make that a much more compelling argument. And if the wisdom of the legislature is to go forward and merge us in there, I would just hope that it's on the basis of specific, tangible things and not vague visions of how things might be one day down in the future. So I guess the most important, because there's, as you can see, this is my ever-growing document folder of things related to this bill and CFEC this session, but that one-page statement I really think does kind of offer a very good synopsis of where we are as an agency. And Madam Chairman, I've met with you a couple times, and you've heard me say this, and I'm going to continue to say it. I really do think that we can do a lot of things on our own, given our existing structure, that will assuage many of your concerns, and we can look at how we can go forward and continue to provide great service to Alaskans as an independent agency in the future. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions any members may have, or turn it over to Commissioner Ruprecht.
Well, I'm going to take my words back, and at this point I am going to ask you a question, and it's going to be the same question I asked you earlier, so you probably have a better answer, hopefully, this time. And my question is, if you know as an agency there are things that need to be done better and that need to be streamlined and that you need to become more effective and efficient, why wasn't this addressed when the bill came out last year? I mean, that's your first heads up, and nothing has been done. Not one thing has been done. Two cases were adjudicated last year, and so my question is, why are you waiting?
And Madam Chairman, it's a fair question, and if I could go back and have done some of the things that we're doing now over the past year, I probably would choose to do that. I did expect this bill to be reintroduced. I think the bill, and I've met with Representative Seaton, who originally had it authored last year, and he's not characterized it to me as something that he thinks is necessarily the definitive answer to how to fix the problem, but it was one way to go about doing it, which is kind of to scoop us out over here and cram us in over here. So we have done some things in the past year. You know, our website has been something we've been working on updating. That was one of the recommendations Mr. Lawson has. And a few weeks ago, we launched the new website. We've continued to have dialogues with our staff about optimum number studies and monitoring these fisheries that may be subject to potential limitation going forward. That is not as far along as it should be, but that work is something that we have done in the years since House Bill 386 was introduced at the end of last session. There are some other things, and we were just in another hearing, Commissioner Ruppert and I, where on the other side of the building, that have to do with technological efficiencies that I think we should really try very, very hard to implement. And that includes the lifetime ability to renew one's permit online. There has been a difference of views among some of the staff about whether that's practical or a good idea. I'm of the opinion now, and this is really hearing directly from representatives of commercial fishermen, that we can't accept that the difficulties prevent us from doing that. We need to have a much easier, user-friendly online presence so that that renewal process isn't burdensome for fishermen. You have specifically, Madam Chairman, raised the question of, and it's one of the things that I think was very helpful that Mr. Harris mentioned, you know, why can we not deliver these permit cards in remote locations as was previously done at least in Kodiak? And that's something that I think we need to set about trying to solve that problem. And that requires, one of the recommendations in Mr. Lawson's report was that we have an executive director, because right now we have three quasi-judicial administrative law judge officers that are also managing personnel, and that has led to a diffusion of decision-making in a manner that's prevented some of these actions taking place. And I own up responsibility. I should not let that happen on my watch, and I promise you that that's not going to be what happens going forward, because we have the capacity to make these changes, and we need to do it. You're absolutely right, Madam Chair.
And I guess I'm just going to make one comment, and then I certainly would, Mr. Twomley, Commissioner Twomley, I would allow you, but my comment is, I appreciate what you said. Talk is cheap. Actions are what we see.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Sorry. Commissioner Twomley.
Madam Chair, yeah, we hope to give you action. But I wanted to add just one footnote. We adjudicated collectively 143 decisions last year, and some of them were very significant, including Violet Wilson. There were two decisions on applications, as you note, and there was another one we concluded just in January. So the cases we had crowded out some of the other cases. There were some interruptions that crowded out some of the other cases that we could have gotten to, but I wanted to put 143 figure on the record.
Okay. Well, you know, and this, I guess this isn't really the time to present it, but, and I won't. Okay, Commissioner Ruppert, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Vern Ruppert. I'm commissioner with Commercial Fisheries Entry. I've been there 60 days or less, so I'm kind of new coming into this. But as Commissioner Brown said, where we are is a commission. First, what we have to understand, and I believe I'm a great believer in historical analysis of things, is why we are, the focus and the locus, what and where. What was the intent of this? We all know historically there was a tremendous crisis in the fisheries industry in the territory of Alaska in the early statehood, particularly with the salmon throughout the history, and one of the drivers of statehood, actually. Every attempt to regulate met with failure due to the conflict with the federal constitution, challenges on the Commerce Clause with the federal government, which marks the field. There was also equal protection problems and discrimination between residents and non-residents, where the state attempted to lock out non-residents. During early 1972, in order to stabilize fisheries, the Alaska Constitution was put to the voters of the state of Alaska, and it passed 78% to modify Article 8, Section 15. Providing for the limited entry and the creation of 1643 XSEC, which is the law that governs us, and then promulgating the Fisheries Commission. Then Governor Egan transmitted a letter to Senate President Terry Miller, who a lot of us knew back years ago, January 10th of 1973, outlining the structure in the Limited Entry Commission. It was 23 pages long, and I know it's part of this record. The governor and the legislature understood that neither the state nor the federal constitution prohibited a state statutory program regulating the access to commercial fishery, so long as the regulatory classifications established to permitting of some people to fish and to exclude others are reasonably related to valid legislative purpose and are fairly applied. It should be noted that the Alaska Constitution does not confer on its citizens a constitutional right to fish. Article 8, Section 3 reserves fish, wildlife, and waters to the people for the common use. So there is something we are completely within our authority to do, but in no case prohibits legislative regulation of that use, nor does the federal constitution permit a regulatory program which discriminates unreasonably against non-residents. Close attention must be paid to the constraints imposed by the Commerce Clause under which a legally sound limited entry program cannot unreasonably burden or discriminate against interstate commerce. A regulatory program which disqualifies non-residents merely to secure an advantage for residents will fail. We saw that in the Zobel case back years ago of a permanent fund. Not so much between the residents and the non-residents, but it was the length of residency, where the original scheme was $50 a year for every year you'd lived in the state since statehood. And they said, well, this isn't going to apply, where they were locking out people on residency issues. As well, any clear discrimination knock us out of the box. Interpreting the Commerce Clause in any given situation is a matter of degree of justification used, and the court will look to the reasonableness of the regulation, which is a type of scrutiny applied by the federal court where the state Supreme Court uses a sliding scale. It's going to be rationally related and reasonable basis test because we're not dealing with a, quote, fundamental right. The prevention of the economic distress amongst fishermen is almost a certainly a valid purpose for this. And if the same standard is applied for the qualification of fish in these waters, the regulation stands an excellent chance of being upheld, as and is almost self-fulfilling. In 42 years of the agency's existence, nearly 43, they've met with an incredible amount of success in judicial review and challenge. The point system applied and everything that guides us to do what we do. So the rationale of the Limited Entry Commission was established a commission, regulatory and quasi-judicial, to administer an entry permit system, moderating who is permitted to fish and who will be excluded and adequate legally and practically as a direct legislative function. However, a full-time regulatory commission can apply general legislative standards to each as to vessels and permits. Another advantage is it's easier to defend legally as long as the statutory purpose and the standards are valid. Any point of legal attack would be aimed at a particular regulation and not the statute itself. The application of a statutory standard as by regulation, which we have the ability to modify and massage and put into place. And the loss of a point or action by the commission does not jeopardize the valid basic program. So when the attacks have come, it's on a regulation and not the entire statutory scheme, which could actually overturn the entire notion of limited entry. Potentially you run that risk in the court. The standards of finding a fact of an applicant's economic dependence and extent of past participation and ability and readiness to do so are weighted. Transferability is allowed. Permits stay in the hands of families who are dependent on the dollars derived. And the commission can also choose fisheries overburdened. And those are all ensconced in the duties of 1643-100. Fish and Game and the Board of Fish have no authority to deal directly in the economic sense with the decision as to who receives the economic benefit of the resource. It would create, no doubt, a clear conflict. They serve three masters: subsistence, sports fish, and commercial fish. They do look at the economics, but where the allocations are going to lie. Only the CFEC actually deals with who, by the point system, by their merit in that point system, get to derive the direct economic or dollar benefit out. And it stands alone for one of those salient purposes. Because all of a sudden you find yourself in a department that has a broader mission and has to serve all the benefit for the maximum use of Alaskans, that resource. Then the question becomes, which master is being served? And these are all potential legal challenges. CFEC is charged with that duty. And by its duties, conservation and economic distress, not who gets the resource under the common use doctrine. And I thought it was very helpful as I pulled out the paper yesterday that the federal people, you know, the article written by Congressman Don Young, is revisiting the Magnuson-Stevens Act by an amendment or by a new bill to ensure it's keeping up with its promise of making the commercial fisheries of the Alaskan waters economically viable and beneficial to Alaskans, and that we can survive on that, because it is nearly an 80,000-person employer in this state, and we are dependent upon it.
and it's the biggest employer in the state of Alaska. And I always believe, in order to get to the point where you're reviewing an agency or you're going to write an analysis on an agency, you first have to know why it was created, who created it, and what was their purpose. And not to discount anything necessarily, there were complimentary things and certainly somewhat critical things in the last report. I didn't recognize in there anywhere, so it went back to the basis as to why we were created the way we were. And we know that it was given a lot of thought, as we can look at the 23-page memo sent by Governor Egan to Terry Miller, the president of the Senate at the time. And they, with all due deliverance, they put 1643 together and it went into law in 90 days. And so far it's been fairly successful because it has met those core challenges by its reasoned decisions, independent, defending its regulations. And as Commissioner Brown, Twomley pointed out, we have that unique ability to look at our regulations and then let's modify them and avoid all of these traps. I mean, having been a practicing lawyer for a number of years, lawyers and I kind of tongue-in-cheek say are always looking for the full employment bill. And when one comes up, believe me, plenty of us are out there looking for those opportunities to bring those actions forward. So I think that needs to be brought under consideration, no matter which way we go, how we be reorganized. And just to further answer the question, we've already begun that process, Chairman Stutz, with the our administrative assistant here in the room and the three commissioners. We've had very close discussions with each other because, in fact, when the bill came up last year, and I was still mayor of the city of Wasilla, I said, that's going to be interesting. Now I find myself here saying, let's jump on this. And, you know, with all due deliverance, you know, no further hate, you know. No hasty decisions, but let's get her done.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this committee? Reverend Christ. Why do I keep saying Reverend? Must be your hairdo or some. Excuse me. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Very monkish. Thank you, Madam Chair. a few questions for the commissioners. Commissioner Twomley, you mentioned the 143 figure. And can you speak to the types of actions that are accounted for in that statistic? Are those emergency transfers? And what is the sort of composition of that number if it could be categorized into different types of?
The bulk of them are transfer cases. And transfer cases, particularly emergency transfer cases, are our highest priority because the immediate right to fish is at stake. We have always considered them the highest priority, and they do push aside application cases. We found some very significant cases there because we found that some of the notices going out of our agency were not telling fishermen everything they needed to know. They weren't securing fishermen the rights that they have under our act and our regulations. So we had to do quite a bit of analysis to improve those notices and give direction to the staff who provides that notice, and that was a big part of it. Another big part of it was the Violet Wilson case, which I put in front of you, and that was a case where I got a call from a citizen in a village that said, there's something wrong here you better look at. And we checked it out, we intervened immediately, and the effect of the case was that we were able to save $40,000 of a grandmother's life savings in a village in Bristol Bay. That was significant to us, and it was something that we did, putting everything else aside to get it done. There were also some Carlson appeals. There were some appeals from point determinations and suspensions in the salmon fisheries. There were other transfer cases. It's that array of cases. And then, of course, there were some application cases.
Follow up?
Yes, please. Representative Tom Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So 143, of those 143, how many were emergency transfers, give or take?
There were about 75 emergency transfers. More than 40 something. I think we may have hit 75. It's an estimate.
Follow up?
Different question. What seems to be a consistent consistent question both with this piece of legislation or last year with Representative Seaton, or question directed to the agency in general, is there's a case backlog. There seems to be sort of a stubborn resistance to getting to the number zero with that backlog. And the backlog is low, but it doesn't seem to be, in recent years, working its way down, at least quickly. And just put directly, why has the backlog not been worked through?
There have been some interruptions in the form of Carlson case, and also we had spent time trying to work on the Quality One decision, which is one that actually kind of rises to the level of the IRS. This one we could talk about, we did get to a point in this last year where transfer cases took precedence, but we are committed to using our best efforts to get through those remaining cases in 2016, and I think we can do that. One of the means of doing that was a recommendation by Tom Lawson that we hire an executive director to take those administrative responsibilities away. And long ago we eliminated our executive director in response to cost cutting, and it was a situation that worked at a time when we had more staff in the agency. At this point, we are kind of substantially reduced. We had, in 1986, we had 41 full-time authorized positions. Today we have 28. And then for 2 years, we went with two commissioners, which spread us a little thin. We actually needed an appointment of a third to get a quorum to complete one of the application cases. I can tell you we're committed to getting through them, and if we can have an executive director taking on the administrative responsibilities, I believe we can do it. We can achieve final determinations in those cases. I could tell you generally over the history of the program that I have been the recipient of a class action in the form of the Carlson case. I was one of the respondents. I've also been represented plaintiffs in class actions suing the state and the federal government. And those class actions took 30 years at least to conclude. And I can tell you that the work of the commission is more labor-intensive, more fact-intensive, more complicated. You have different point systems for almost every fishery that's been limited. It's more demanding, I believe, than the work that went into those class actions. It's the nature of the thing. It's very labor-intensive, takes a lot of time, and you need blocks of time to produce decisions. But if we conduct the administrative responsibilities by hiring an executive director, we can commit the blocks of time to get the decisions out, and that's what we're pledged to do.
Follow up. This is maybe a comment or a question for the chair. From the testimony of the commissioners, it seems as though one of the prime arguments for maintaining the status quo and preserving CFEC and the structure surrounding CFEC is legal risk associated with moving everything over to ADF&G and the Office of Administrative Hearings. And I was wondering if in the future there's plans to have the Department of Law or another sort of outside perspective on that question shed a little light on the risk that we might be taking on.
I think I could have Reed address that. I think that he has addressed that with the Department of Law. Reed, could you come forward?
I could do an hour
wrap-up. Okay. Wrap-up? Fine. Any other questions? I just have a couple comments. If you could provide this committee with the breakdown of the 143 cases as to which type they were, we would appreciate that.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And just when was the last fishery limited?
It goes back to 2004.
Okay. Just clarifying that. Okay. And no other questions? I appreciate it, gentlemen. Appreciate your time.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. And next Next up, we're going to have the Department of Fish and Game, and I saw Commissioner Cotton here a few minutes ago, and we have Deputy Commissioner Brooks present. Please come forward, state your name for the record. I don't know where Commissioner Cotton is.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. I had a few prepared comments on the bill and would be happy to answer any questions afterward. First, I would recognize your effort, Rep. Stutes, as far as taking on such a substantive piece of legislation. I also wanted to start, too, by recognizing the significant work and contribution that CFEC has made over the years. I mean, they've been in existence for 40-plus years. You heard the history and how they came about, but the work they've done on behalf of Alaskan fishermen is admirable, and keeping permits in state and those types of things has been quite a body of work. But as you heard in previous testimony, I won't cover it again. It seems to have changed and evolved over that 40-year period, so that we're in a period now where we've gone from 900 cases to 28, haven't limited a fishery since 2004, I think it was put on the record. So is the current structure appropriate for the current workload? I guess this really kind of gets to the crux of the question. And the challenge, I think, before the committee and considering the bill is, how do you maintain that presence in the event that maybe another fishery gets limited or we continue to do appeals and issue licenses? How do you maintain a core level to take on a future body of work? You know, we've spent the last couple of months here working through some pretty significant budget challenges. There's a $3.5 billion deficit. Don't need to tell anybody in the room that news, but I think it's safe to say that all state agencies are looking real hard at how do you streamline, how do you do things more efficient, how do you combine or consolidate or just fundamentally change how you might have been doing things over a lot of years. And I know, speaking for the Department of Fish and Game and the other divisions, we are certainly actively engaged in that process. We have a plan to meet once session is over in May to kind of map out the next 3 years, because we know this is not one and done this year in the level of cuts that we're looking at in our budget. So we're planning and strategizing how we can offer our programs with the least negative impact on the citizens that rely on what we do. And it's with that consideration that we would take on looking at this bill and what you're trying to accomplish with HB 112. The department believes that we could make this work without service degradation to commercial fishermen. I think that's important. Issuing permits, doing emergency transfers, those types of things. It's not that it won't be complicated. It's not that you just turn a switch and make that happen. But we believe we could make it work. We believe we could find some improvements. I think that was brought up by one of the previous testifiers. You know, just on the administrative side of things, we pay bills, we do budgets, we pay people, we have HR, human resource issues, we provide desktop support to our employees. All those kinds of things, I believe, those administrative type of functions certainly could benefit from being part of a bigger team that could probably, or I won't say probably, I'll correct that word, potentially enhance service delivery. I think on the licensing side, this is a big part of what CFEC does, issuing those licenses, doing emergency transfers, doing permanent transfers. We have a little bit of experience in doing licensing in Fish and Game. It's a different type of licensing. We issue recreational hunting and fishing licenses to residents and non-residents. We issue about 700,000 pieces of stock annually, generating about $25 million. We also have commercial crew license revenue. We issue about 25,000 licenses to crew members on vessels, and we do that effectively and efficiently. You know, limited entry commission issues about 25 to 30,000 licenses and permits themselves, and they do these transfers, and they're important because, as they've stated, when it comes down to opportunity to fish, you have to do what's necessary to put fishermen in their boats and in the water, making a living. So those would all be things that we would have to care for, certainly, and work to staff that's currently there and how they perform those functions and try to make as smooth a transition as possible. The Fisherman's Fund was raised, and I would see no impact. I would agree with previous testimony that there'd be no impact on that. That's a statutory formula. There's a contribution based on a percentage of the license fees that it's deposited into the Fisherman's Fund, which is basically a workers' compensation fund for fishermen. We actually make a contribution to that fund as well with our commercial crew license revenue, so that would certainly be an easy thing to accommodate. I guess I could pause there, Madam Chair, and be happy to answer any questions or provide a clarification on my comments.
Thank you. Is there any questions from this committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anything in statute or contracting that would prohibit bringing the current employees on as either represented or non-represented or employees?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, as I understand that the employees would transfer into the department, they would become classified employees. And there's a process for doing that. The movement from exempt status to classified, it has been done before with the case that was noted by staff. I won't say it's not complicated because everything in bureaucracy tends to be, but there's a way to do that and the path forward for doing it.
And I guess for the record, Madam Chair, if I could, it would be mandatory that they became?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, I guess I would look for a legal interpretation of that, but my understanding would be that all the staff, with the exception of the executive director or division director, would be classified.
Thank you. I might note at this time, online, we have the Ledge Legal from Juneau here, Alpheus Bullard, and also Chris Kennedy from the Office of Administrative Hearings, if there's any questions for either of those individuals from this committee. Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you. This is a question for Alpheus. Alpheus, you heard Commissioner all the commissioners' testimony that this would sort of have the potential to upset the legal apple cart, so to speak, if a precedent were reversed, it could be applied retroactively to fishermen and create a lot of downstream problems. What's your assessment of that risk?
Representative Christ-Tompkins, through the chair, I'd have to review that. I don't know what the likelihood of that scenario is.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I would ask that Reed Harris return to the hot seat for a wrap-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Before we go any further, let me see if there's any questions.
Slides are done.
No, sorry.
Okay. Wrap up, Mr. Harris, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Reed Harris, Staff to Representative Stutes. It was mentioned by Commissioner Brown with the fiscal note saying this amendment, speaking to the amendment here, excuse me, would need a new fiscal note. I do believe this is accurate. However, saying that it would be significantly larger than what is currently being handled, the workload that OAH currently anticipates handling may not be entirely accurate. I'm going to read just a brief section from the fiscal note from the Department of Administration regarding OAH. It's the fiscal note with the $61,900 number on the front if you need help finding it. Section 121 of the bill provides that litigation and hearings pending at the time of the act become effective may be continued and completed. OAH understands that the continuing litigation and hearings pending would be completed under the jurisdiction of OAH and ADF&G. I take this to mean, and possibly it's a good question for Mr. Kenny, that OAH is already anticipating handling the adjudications on these cases. In our talks with the department and with OAH, we've stated that's how it would be. The bill was admittedly a bit nebulous at first, which required the amendment as to who would truly be doing it. What would DFG have control over, and what would OAH have control over? The amendment makes it clear that OAH will be hearing the caseload themselves. So if you care to ask Mr. Kennedy a question, he may or may not be able to answer that.
Did you hear the question, Mr. Kennedy?
Madam Chair, yes, I did hear the question. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the fiscal note was written on the assumption that the 28 limitation cases that are, the 28 initial permit cases that are currently pending, that those would have reached a stage by the time of the transfer of litigation to the Office of Administrative Hearings, that the remaining proceedings would take place in the Department of Fish and Game. As a result, we did not look closely at the process leading to a final decision on that class of cases, and I believe the intent of the amendment is probably to transfer final decision authority over those cases to us, and I simply will have to tell you we'd have to go back and look at what that would entail. I'm just not in a position to comment on whether that would have an impact on our fiscal note or not.
Thank you.
Copy. To wrap up that section, we'll be ordering a new fiscal note from the Department of Administration as soon as we get the new version of the bill with this amendment in it. The second point I'd like to make is I did a disservice to the commission by stating they'd adjudicated two cases last year. I misspoke, and what I meant to say was they handled two permit applications last year. Yes, they did do 143 total cases, including permit applications, transfer cases, and emergency transfer cases. Again, some of these cases date back to the 1980s. They predate me. There's understandable that there would be delays at times because of emergency transfers that come before the commission, creates a spike in workload, and some of these cases are admittedly complicated. I believe you have three different cases in your committee packets here which required massive amounts of man time and hearings in any number of courts. Still, these cases have existed for 25, 30 years. It just begs the question, why is House Bill 112 necessary to get the CFEC to finalize all of these cases? And one parting comment, Section 121 of the bill, if I could turn your attention to it, it's on page 46. Both Commissioner Rupright and Commissioner Brown and Representative Christ Tompkins, this ties into the question you asked earlier, had questions regarding the transition language being Section 121. So I'll read from the bill for a quick moment if you didn't mind. Saying, certificates, orders, and regulations issued or adopted under authority of a law amended or repealed by this act remain in effect for the term issued or until revoked, vacated, or otherwise modified under the provisions of this act. Contracts, rights, including, I would assume, the right to fish, liabilities, and obligations created by or under a law amended or repealed by this act and in effect of the effective date of this act remain in effect notwithstanding this act's taking effect. So the question was, or the concern brought up by Commissioner Rupright was that by essentially changing the rules of how limited entry works, we could be opening ourselves up to a Pandora's box of back cases where possibly someone 30 years ago did not get a permit and saying, well, hey, the rules for entry have changed, I want another shot at this. I ran this by Alpheus, the drafting attorney, and I was told, and possibly he'd like to speak on this as well, that this still holds, that all of the rulings the commission has done through the past, well, since limited entry began, would still stand up.
Mr. Bowler, do you have a comment to that?
Uh,
this is obvious, Ballard at Ledge Legal through the chair. What is your specific question, please?
Whether or not we would be opening, the state would be opening itself to repercussions from previously resolved cases through the CFEC or determinations if this bill were to take effect.
Again, this is Althea Spillard at Ledge Legal. I'm not sure how that would happen. I mean, things would be different if this bill were enacted than they were before, but I'm not sure what avenue someone would have to claim that a previously adjudicated decision should be reopened. I can't imagine what that is.
Thank you.
That was all I had, Madam Chair. If you have further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Are there any questions from this committee? Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you. Mr. Harris, you said there are two permit applications resolved this last year. Say over the last decade, how has that number changed year by year?
If you would excuse me from the table for 1 second. Representative Christ-Tompkins, through the chair. I have, or you have in your copy, your bill packet, a copy of a section of the 2007 CFEC annual report. It has a graph in it here. I brought this up in committee earlier, but if you're asking about the past decade, this report only goes through 2007 since it was when it was issued. But if you look at 1997, you can see the total number of cases was sitting at right under 600, and down into 2007, it looks like about 115 or so. So the cases up through 2007 were kicking off at a relatively rapid rate. I wish I had last year's annual report and an equal graph that possibly showed that possibly those cases have petered off a little bit.
Okay. Any further questions for the sponsor? Thank you, Mr. Harris. Hearing no further questions, I will set this bill aside for a future hearing. We will be taking, once again, we'll be taking public testimony on this bill on Thursday, March 26th, 10 a.m., right here in room 120 or online. We will meet again on March 24th, and we will be holding our first State of the Salmon discussion. Presenters addressing our salmon issues. I thank you all, and I will adjourn this meeting at 11:10.